The nonprofit MBA purpose is to provide new business insights and fresh creative ideas for executive directors and their teams that will help them improve their organization. Here is your host, Stephen Halasnik.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Stephen Halasnik, and I will be your host for today's nonprofit MBA podcast, like I've been for over 6 years. I am co-founder of Financing Solutions, and we are the leading provider of lines of credit for small nonprofits. That is going on way too long. I'm sorry about that. Something happened there, so the loop. So anyway, welcome everyone. Again, my name is Steve Halasnik, and I am co-founder of Financing Solutions. For those of you who don't know us, for the last 13 years, we have been the leading provider of lines of credit for small nonprofits in the United States. Yes, we are. Let's see, we are in 47 states. We have, you know, thousands of clients. The line of credit is very, very popular. And if you're interested in learning more about the line of credit for your nonprofit, please visit us at nonprofitmbapodcast.com. And today I'm very excited to be speaking with Sean Kozofsky from Mind the Gap Consulting. Sean is a coach, consultant, trainer, and strategic advisor. For the past 30 plus years, he has helped causes, campaigns, and candidates raise millions of dollars and transform nonprofit organizations and leaders. He has served in a wide variety of roles in nonprofits, including policy, communications, development, grassroots organizing, direct service board leadership, and five stints as an executive director. He has worked on a wide range of issues, including LGBTQ equality, reproductive justice, voting access, bullying prevention, climate change, and more. Sean, welcome to today's Nonprofit MBA podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, today we're going to be talking about why and how to select a good nonprofit coach. And for our listeners to know, for several years early on in my career, I had a business coach before it became fashionable. And so, it really helped me build my organization. And it also helped me develop quicker as well as a leader and as a manager. So, Sean, typically, when people are coming to you to be their business coach, what is the most common reason why they're doing that?
Usually when folks find their way to my business, they're not sure what they need. They're not sure if they need consulting or if they need coaching. Sometimes they know that they need coaching for sure. But basically, earlier career executive directors and leaders in nonprofits, whether they're founders, maybe they're even a board chair, but usually it's an executive director or CEO of a nonprofit. By the time they have found their way to me, they are either an early career person facing imposter syndrome, or they are facing uncertainty in what the job is. Like, they literally don't know what the job is. There's no onboarding. There's no there's no manual for how to do the executive director job. And they're certainly just like, the board just doesn't work there. They're volunteers and they don't work there. So they give you the keys and say, here, go run this place. So there's a little bit of like, how are all those pieces connected? How do I interact with my board? So making sense of the role, that's part of it. Or the imposter syndrome, lack of confidence. Am I really the person for this role? I don't have all the skills and training that other people do, and wondering whether they're really the right fit. Other folks, maybe mid-career to later career folks who come to me, are usually facing burnout. And whether it's like post-COVID stuff, or it's just they went through a merger, or they went through the recession, or they went through something really difficult, and they're just not really sure if this is the right next move for them. So those are the kinds of situations people come to me with, is sort of like, you know, imposter syndrome or early confusion around the role, or even possibly some burnout.
I've been hearing that term imposter syndrome for the past year or two. It seems like it's a more recent term. I mean, I certainly think that the idea behind the imposter syndrome has been there. It just seems that we've coined it now. Is that fair to say?
I think imposter syndrome has been a word that people have been saying. I know how words can sort of like pop into our consciousness and awareness in like the landscape, but I really think this one has been for about 5 or 10 years now. I've been hearing it from executive directors. maybe it's because the way that people end up in nonprofit leadership is like, we'll take people from anywhere, business, government, we'll take folks from lots of different places. So it is like a, such a new thing. We hear it more in nonprofit leadership. So I feel like it's been around for a little bit longer, but it's certainly happening more, as you've noticed, in the past year or two, for sure. I think there's been a huge transition in leadership since the racial reckoning after George Floyd, and certainly after COVID. There's been a huge influx of people changing roles and wondering whether they have the support they need and whether they're the right fit for the, that the organization needs, for sure.
Yeah, it's not, I'm not making a sexist comment here. I'm making an, well, you know, it's kind of tough to say this, but it's, I noticed that women really suffer so much more from this idea of imposter syndrome, the idea that they think that they're not capable, not qualified. Let's use that word, not qualified for a certain job. And so they feel nervous, anxiety about it. Is that been your observation as well?
Yeah, I think in nonprofit leadership, I do believe I see a lot more women in leadership roles reporting that they are lacking the confidence or lacking the credibility or the credentials or the experience. But I certainly don't think it's because they're women. I think it is because we raise our boys and our men to sort of just like go out and do and fake it till you make it and apply for jobs you're not qualified for and just sort of like go for it, right? And women are far more likely to say, I don't have the skills for that. I won't apply for that. Or now I'm in this role. It's a lot more humble, a lot more humility, a lot more being more self-aware. But guys won't report as much imposter syndrome. But I do have a bunch of people who arrive with me as coaches, as men. They will say that word right out of the gate if they are a new executive director. But I think in general, women are more likely to report it than men. But I think that partly has nothing to do with women or their leadership. I think it really has to do with like how much we prepare men for executive roles, and we don't prepare women as much for executive roles. And so they go in like recounting that they're not sure if they're prepared, and really they are just as prepared as the men.
Yeah, I like what you said too at the end, which is that they're prepared. I mean, the things that I've seen that women make a big deal about, and try, I want to be careful here, but they think they need to be prepared for everything. Mm-hmm. And humanly impossible. College doesn't prepare you for leadership and management roles. It just teaches you how to learn.
I think it certainly, there is a maturity around knowing whether it's okay to live in the gray zone. If it's okay to live with ambiguity, it's okay that the role will reveal itself. Yeah. I think it has more to do with like maturity. I know when I got my first executive director job, I thought I needed to know it all on the first day. For me, it was a tremendous sense of care. It was the fact that if I messed something up, I could take the whole organization down with me. I was so worried. I tend to overthink and over worry about things like compliance. When I talk to so many people, like the compliance stuff will work itself out. You generally have to pay a little bit of attention to that. You're not really going to mess up. And even if you mess up, there's a fine. You're not going to lose the whole organization. What you really need to focus on is fundraising, right? But I have found that for me, because I went through that experience of not wanting to mess up my first executive director role, I have a great deal of empathy for those who feel like they need to be prepared on day one. But you're right. I think it has more to do with a sign of business training and leadership training and maturity around being okay with ambiguity. And I think for some reason, men are a little bit more likely to be like, I'll figure it out. Now, I know a lot of women who just figure it out and just muddle yep. through and dive into roles, whether it's motherhood or whether it's entrepreneurship or whether it's consulting, and do the same thing. But in the executive nonprofit role, I do think we are not preparing female executives as much as men. And that is why we're hearing that a little bit more from women in this role. We are not people of color. Also, we're not always setting them up with the same supports that men might be getting in terms of mentorship and cross-training and just giving them an extra hand. So I don't know why that is, but I definitely think I have some suspicions.
I mean, I'm going to have to correct something you said, and that is you said we're not preparing the women like we are the men. No one's preparing men to do those roles. It might happen because of a variety of other reasons, but it's not like somebody's sitting there saying, oh, well, we're preparing you for leadership or we're preparing you for man. That doesn't happen. You know,
it all depends on your experience. So I kind of came up, I was brought into an LGBT civil rights organization in Michigan when I was 20 years old. And my mentor, my best friend, was running this statewide civil rights organization at the time. He took me under his wing. I was driving him around. We used all of the time we had together for him to teach me and show me. He was like, I don't think that if I had been a 20-year-old woman, I would have gotten the same attention and care. I think he saw me as like a younger male, sort of like coming up in the movement, and we bonded. There was a connection that we had. So I benefited from his leadership in the sense that we had some time together. And I'm not sure if he would have ended up partying as much or going out for drinks with me as much. The things we did and bonded with as men, I think those opportunities brought us together and I could absorb all of his leadership more. I think there are more male executives willing to take younger guys in their organizations under their wing and spend more time with them than maybe a younger female associate. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. But because there are more male executives than there are women executives historically in the past 30 years in nonprofits, I think that mentorship and cross-training and coaching is happening in so subtle ways. But you're right, we're not training. There's no programs for men.
I mean, I would counteract that. My first manager was a woman, and you know, she mentored me. And I think, you know, women are really intelligent. They're so much more intelligent than men. And it's a generalization, but I mean, I have hired a lot of women because they tend to do a better job. And so I think if you're, I don't know, it depends on the, on,
yeah,
I don't know. So I would counteract that a little bit. If you have somebody, I don't care if they're male, I don't care if they're female. If you show ambition and you want to learn and you're willing to put the time in, I don't think it really matters you're male or female, honestly. And I think maybe you just showed that you were interested and they saw that. But let's move into something else. And that is I want to tell you too, I mean, the reason why I brought on a coach, this was, you know, 20 years ago. Going back to something you're saying about maturity, what's interesting was the first maybe several to 10 years that I was in a leadership position, I felt uncomfortable telling my employees I didn't know. Mm-hmm. But once I got more mature and I learned more about management and leadership, I learned it was okay to say I didn't know.
Right.
You know, so it, I think maturity does play a big part in that. And so, and also when you know just enough about your job where you can feel comfortable to say, you know what, I don't know, let's figure it out. Right. And your employees appreciate that. But I had gone to my coach because I felt I wasn't a good manager. So I felt bad about that. And I wanted to be a better manager. And that's what my coach helped me with. Now everybody goes to a coach for a different reason. But that was for me. Do you see that happening also?
Yeah, I think people want their leaders to be decisive, but they don't always expect they rarely expect their leaders to have all the answers to everything. By definition, if you're a leader, you're first in, you're trying something innovative, you're exploring new things, whether you're an entrepreneur or a nonprofit leader, you are encountering new challenges all the time. We don't know exactly what we're going to do. What you're hired for is your judgment. What you're hired for is how you marshal all of the resources around you to get through those big decision points, right? So it's not that the leader needs to have those things. So, you know, as men and as leaders and as women who are running organizations, we are sometimes looked to have all the answers. But I think it really is a sign of authenticity and a sign of vulnerability to be able to say, I don't have all the answers, but the point is you hired me to get results. I'm going to find the right answers. I'm going to like get the right ideas in the room, get the right fact finding, and we're going to decide this together. And so I do believe that that does take a sense of humility. And I think that more and more folks are sort of realizing that what we have put on leaders has not really necessarily been fair. And it's a really isolating thing. This is one of the things people come to me for as a coach also is the isolation of the role. When you're an executive director, there's really no training. You're making this up as you go. You're sort of like building the plane as you're flying it, all the euphemisms, right? And you also need to, you need to position yourself as really strong and confident and that you have it all under control to your board, and also the same to your staff. But really inside you might be like, I have no idea what the heck I'm doing. And that can make it very, very isolating. You can't tell anyone. So I tell a lot of executive directors, you need to have other executive directors in your support network, right? Like other EDs that you can talk to. And if you don't, you need a coach. And you definitely should have a coach regardless. But if you have other EDs, you might be able to let some of that steam out, right? Like, I've never hired someone before. I've never fired someone before. I've never had to fire a board member, and talking to other EDs about the unique things they're going through, like my personal life and my work life are blending together and I don't even know the difference anymore. So that being able to have someone to talk to is part of the value of being a coach, but also that EDs really do have, executive directors really do have this isolation that they're going through because they haven't really been prepared for ambiguity or been prepared for not knowing the answers.
Yeah, I completely agree with you 100%. I mean, those two things I've almost had my whole career. And, you know, I've always had a forum group of peers. And, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, for maybe several years, I've had a coach, and it became less important. But I had that coach I mentioned before, one of the reasons why. But the other reason was everybody, you know, In the organizations I'd run, they all had managers that they could talk to about things, but I, as the owner of the companies, I didn't. So I wanted a coach to be somebody who I can talk issues with that, and it's really not that expensive also. And I think as an executive director, one of the things you can do is if you're going to start a new job or if you're in a new job, you know, you can go to the board and you can say, "Is you know what? I really need a coach. I need somebody to be on my side, and I need somebody outside the organization who can help me deliver." You know, and if you get this coach for me, then I think I can deliver more than the plan, and then I think that's going to be money well invested. And I think those are conversations that almost nobody has, but yet a board can understand the value of that.
Yeah, I think admitting that you need a coach for some people feels like you're admitting that you can't do it all.
It could be. Yeah. I. What do you think?
It's like saying you want to go see a therapist, right? Like there's this like resistance I think some leaders have to saying, "Oh, if I need a coach, that must mean I don't have this, you know, I don't have this down, or I'm not competent or confident enough in my role." There are some folks who believe that engaging a coach is like that. And I probably resisted having a coach for years until around like age 35 or 36 when I had my first coach. And it was like life-changing, better than any therapy I had been in. And I really, the whole course of my career was changed because of my coach. In its barest form, coaching is about managing change. It is about managing transformation. Here's the current state where you are. Here's the place you want to go. We're going to help manage that change to your transformational future self. So all coaching is basically helping people through that. If you're just shooting the shit, you know, pardon my French, if you're just kind of like talking and gossiping every week, you're not really doing coaching. You're just providing support. And that's fine. And sometimes you just need that. And my coachees will come in and say, "I just need to vent this week. I'm not going to work the program." I'm like, that's perfectly fine. So being in their corner, having their back, all of that stuff is part of it. But in the trajectory, why most coaches don't do one session or three, they do 6 months, 12 months, because you need to manage change over time. And so so I do believe that that is true, that there's a reluctance to maybe engage a coach. But for those of us that have benefited from one, we're like, "Oh my God, I couldn't imagine not using my coach. I couldn't imagine not." That's one of the most sacred times on the calendar is when you get to work with your coach.
Yeah, I think I would actually change the word. So I would say I know somebody who's in, Sean. I know somebody, not Sean, but, you know, I know this guy, Sean, who's an industry expert consultant in nonprofits. And I'd like to hire him for 2 hours a month, to help make sure that we achieve the goals that are set out to us. I can see where that would get past the idea. Like, listen, I'm very modern. I've always been ahead of the pack when it comes to those things. If someone said coach to me, I'd be like, I get it.
Right.
But I think you're right. Other people might not. So if I use the word consultant,
right,
then sometimes I'm like, oh.
Sometimes the word consultant is used. Sometimes the word trainer is used. Sometimes the word advisor is used. I go by the nonprofit fixer. So you can actually call me a fixer. Like, we need to bring in a fixer to our nonprofit. Joke about being a fixer. But
although general, fixer means that there's something to be fixed already. So, you know, if I'm a new executive director, you know, that's, you know, I go back to what you're saying, which I think is fair, that they're thinking, and I'm going to be fixing things, which I am, but,
yeah, totally.
You know, but
I help organizations fix the problems inside the organ. Like, the company's name is Mind the Gap Consulting, which is sort of like filling these gaps. Where are there holes? Where are there gaps and where you're trying to go? And then we try to fix those holes, right? Not trying to fix people. They're not broken. But we are trying to fix situations. And usually it's the executive director chair relationship. Right? There's something broken about this relationship or some trust, or there's an imbalance of power. A lot of nonprofit executive directors don't get employment contracts. I don't know why this is. I didn't have an employment contract till I was 32 or 33. But essentially, once you have an employment contract, you have a different kind of sense of confidence. And in the private sector, employment contracts are kind of standard, right? Especially in corporate worlds. But most nonprofit executive directors, you're working for a bunch of volunteer board members who don't even work there, right? So you're at a whim of like a couple of them gunning for you. You need an employment contract. You need to be thinking about the organization and not constantly worrying about your job. You can't be at will when you're a nonprofit executive director. So coaching them through the things they need to do.
That's a great idea.
And have that kind of confidence. But most nonprofit EDs do not have a contract.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. What typically, how long is an employment contract for typically?
Typically, it all depends. If you've got a different horizon on your career, you might only want to do a 1 year, you know, contract, right? Some people, I'm still trying out this organization. So I'm going to do a 1 year contract and it just automatically renews at the end of every year unless someone interrupts it, right? But most contracts are 2 years. Many corporate ones are 4 years, right? So you're going to find anywhere between 1 and 4 year contracts for a lot of different places. I think for a lot of people, 1 to 2 years feels about right. And I think that it usually benefits the worker, not the employer. So if someone wants to leave, no employer is going to force you to stay through the end of your contract. It's mostly there to protect the worker than it is to protect the employer. But a good player, a good person who has a contract, they would try to serve out the rest of their contract.
Right? Oh, I think it's a great idea, and especially for the executive director, because you know, you want to get that organization to make a commitment to you to give you some time. And if someone brought that to my attention, I'd be like, that's a, you know, like if an executive director came to me and said, I want an employment contract, I would know. I was like, oh, this person knows what they're doing. They know what they're doing. Right. If they want that, they want this, you'd be like, listen, I'm going to need a year or two to fix the problems that are going on here or to achieve the goals that you want. And, you know, I need to know that you're committed and the board's committed.
Some executive directors are even willing to pay. They're willing to work for even less pay for the guarantee of security. Right. Like, I was offered a job once where because my husband does really, really well, I didn't need to take as much money. I said, my husband's doing really well. It's more money than I've ever made. I'm not going to even negotiate. I will take the salary you've offered, but I actually want an employment contract. So the security of knowing that I was protected and could not be fired without cause at all gave me great support. And if you're working in any kind of field where you might feel like you need to blow the whistle, let's say you're working in a field where you're working with kids and maybe you see something that you need to report. There are things you might see in the nonprofit where you have to surface that you saw them and you're not going to be afraid of losing your job because you have an employment contract, right? Teachers face this all the time. So that's why union members have contracts also, because they're not worried about like sounding the alarm about something unsafe that they see, right? So employment contracts give you the protection of that. But also what I remind employers of is that they cost $0 to give. It costs the board $0 to give me an employment contract. The only way it's going to cost you any money is if you fire me without cause. You're not going to fire me without cause, and I'm not going to do anything that's going to get me fired without cause, right? So in general, it doesn't cost the organization anything to give this level of protection of a severance, right? So I think that it's a win-win for everyone. I get to focus not on whether I'm going to be fired next month, but actually focusing on the mission, right? I'm not going to worry about the noise and the distraction of an angry, loud board member who's coming after my job because I have the protections of a contract. So those are one of the things I help my clients with when they come to me for coaching, is figuring out how to protect their career and their family and their mortgage and their everything, you know, by getting an employment contract.
Do you have a boilerplate
contract?
Employment contract?
Yep. I sell it on my website for like $50 or something.
You go get it.
It's been written so that it can work in all 50 states. You should definitely take it and have it modified in your state by an attorney. But in general, it just says, if you materially change my role, if you bring in a co-director, after you said I was the solo director, if you move headquarters, if you materially change the role, you're in breach. If anything happens at all that is terminating me without cause, that's totally fine. You have every right to fire me without cause. You run the organization, but you're going to pay me, right? If you do that, I will have taken myself off the market. And therefore, because I did that, you need to pay me out for having to be on the job search again. All of those things are in this employment contract that I sell.
In your experience, when you are working with newer clients, what percentage of the time do you see that people have employment contracts?
Only the largest organizations typically do. It tends to be organizations with $5 million budgets or larger, maybe $3.5 million budgets or larger, where you start getting executives coming in that are used to and accustomed to having a contract. But many organizations under 3 million, I usually see the ED not having a contract at all.
Yep.
And that's the vast majority of nonprofits. There's 1.5 million nonprofits in this country. Maybe 80, 90% of them are under $600,000 budget. So the vast majority do not have contracts.
What would you advise a client of yours who is already at a nonprofit? And they're smaller, let's say, right? 3 million. Okay. They're already there. They haven't negotiated an employment contract. How would you broach that topic with somebody?
All you need to do is ask for it. So you don't have to be coming in from scratch to do it. I have a client right now that I coached into an executive director employment contract. She is a founder. She helped create the organization almost 10 years ago and then wanted the protections of a contract. So we went to the board and said, here's what we're coming up on an annual review. This is what we're asking for this year. And so you just go to the board and say, I want these protections. And because it costs no one anything, it just takes a shift in mindset, right? It's a concession. Sometimes just asking for the contract is a negotiable item. And if they don't give it to you, then maybe you win something else, right? So asking for more than you think you're going to get is going to help you get something else that maybe you want, like maybe a 4-day work week, which I also train organizations on how to do. If we can't pay people what they're worth in the sector, we should definitely be doing things like the 4-day work week and employment contracts. But definitely you can go to your board currently and say, as we move forward, as we're professionalizing, as we're growing, as I helped navigate this place through a global pandemic, I want the protections of a contract, right? And just go to your board and ask for it. And to have confidence in doing it instead of like acting like it's a favor that they're doing. It is in the board's best interest that their executive feels safe, right? They want to hold you for a couple of years too. It is in everyone's interest.
In that case, where she went back to the board and ask for an employment contract, what was the board's reaction?
They immediately were sort of like, okay, we haven't done this before. What does this look like? What's the language? What are the terms? And they went along with it. I think that the board chair was her cheerleader and so knew that this was okay. There's also a lawyer on the board who is very sophisticated about this, a good friend of mine. Very sophisticated about employment contracts and knew how to negotiate them. It really came down to the size of the severance. How generous would the severance be? That was the only term at the end. And we were able to convince the board that you're never going to spend this because you're never going to fire the person without cause, right? So just like give this person the security, and they got a one-year severance. You know, they'd been there 9 years. They were the founder. They put their career on hold to start this place and were able to get a one-year severance.
What was the impetus for the executive director to want to have the employment contract?
I think when you start the first time, even if you're a founder, like this particular client, she was a founder. So she created it and she built a board of people that were kind of loyal to her. All it takes is your first run-in with a board member who starts acting kind of secretive or acting kind of pushy, where you're like, oh my God, this could turn south. If you only have a board of six people, you only need three to get you out. Right. All it takes is a rumor or a misunderstanding, the minute something goes wrong, you cannot ask for a contract. Like the minute something, people start questioning your leadership or a mistake happens or a crisis in the media, you start asking for a contract, you're not going to get one. No one's going to give you a contract when there's trouble. They're going to hold off. So you need to ask for it before there's a problem. So I think that she could see that she wanted to head off at the pass any kind of challenge before it happened. I've been preaching this for years. She hears me talk about it all the time. Finally got her head above water and said, finally, this is the year we've done really well on fundraising. We're going to ask for more money and an employment contract.
What question haven't I asked or area that I haven't, that we haven't talked about that, you know, you think is important when we're talking about today's topic is, which is why and how to select a good nonprofit coach. What haven't I covered?
I think that the main thing people need to know when they're considering coaching is the framework, right? It's different than consulting. Now, many coaches out there are coaching you through solutions. They're helping you solve things. I call that consulting. Right. But many coaches are, they're basically consulting and coaching. It's like coach consulting. It's like a combination thing. But the framework typically is that a consultant is a subject matter expert that helps you solve problems. And a coach does not need to be a subject matter expert at all. They are an expert on helping you learn and grow and maybe someone in your corner and stretch you and help you hit your goals. They don't need to be from your exact industry. It helps if they do. The benefit of me is that I'm a consultant and a coach. I'm both a subject matter expert in nonprofits and I can do coaching. But a lot of coaches will come into the nonprofit sector never having worked in the nonprofit sector, and they're going to be at a disadvantage. So the framework is you typically work in 3, 6, or 12 month increments with a coach, and you just pay as you go, or you pay by the session. Usually you pay by the package, and you can work through in confidence. You know, even if the employer, even if the organization is paying the bill, those sessions should be confidential, completely confidential. You won't have a good coaching relationship unless those sessions are confidential. So the framework is usually 3, 6, or 12 months, sometimes longer. The sessions are completely confidential, no matter who pays for it. And basically, and some people do come to me paying out of pocket. They're like, I'm about to apply for my first executive director job. No one's paying this bill for me. I want to learn this role before day one. And they just start paying for it. And hopefully maybe they'll get some professional development allocations later on that they can get reimbursed for it. But a lot of folks come to me and just pay out of pocket.
All good stuff. It was a great podcast. Yeah, it's kind of all the time we have for today. I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot. I'd like to thank so very much Sean Kozofsky from Mind the Gap Consulting for coming on today's podcast. And if you like today's podcast, please feel free to share it with your friend. The podcast is in the top 1% of podcasts in the nonprofit space. And also, if you like today's podcast or only or any of the past ones, please give us a 5-star review. It helps us get the word out. And if you're looking for a line of credit for your nonprofit, please feel free to visit our website at nonprofitmbapodcast.com. Sean, if anyone wants to get in touch with you, how would they go about doing that?
Definitely go to nonprofitfixer.com. That's my website. I'm on all the different social media channels at nonprofitfixer. So just go find me anywhere there, but definitely go to the website. You'll find a bunch of free tools there and find a way to get in touch with me.
Great. Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you.
So I just want to remind all our listeners out there that you guys are out there every single day trying to solve, you know, major problems and making the world a better place. And I want to thank you. I know Sean thanks you for that too. But just keep in mind that saving the world is a marathon and not a sprint. And you need to take really good care of yourself. You're no good to your family, your employee, your friends, yourself, if you don't think about yourself every single day, because most of you I know are thinking about your cause first, and then you think of yourself or your family, you know, after that. That doesn't really work well for marathons. And so please, you know, the night before you go to work or on the weekends, take that time to take good care of yourself so that you have the energy in the long run to solve these major problems that are going on. And sometimes it takes someone like me just to remind you, you should come first. All right. Everybody have a fantastic day. And thank you for listening to the Nonprofit MBA Podcast.